Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 44 with Joanne Hall. We've got a great show this episode. Ensemble member Anna Zinsmeister interviews Joanne Hall, who owns the Elkhorn Mountains Weaving Studio and Glamokra USA, the major distributor of Glamokra looms in North America. They talk about Swedish looms and especially draw loom weaving, which is a way to create complex pictorial designs on a non-computerized loom without having to do manual pickup. Isn't that cool? Then finally, the story of what the Weavers Guild of Greater Baltimore is doing to celebrate their 60th anniversary. Before we get into all that, I'd like to play you a promo for Craftlit. This is a podcast that takes classic literature that's in the public domain and creates audiobooks. Heather has done a wide variety of titles, and now she's about to tackle one of my favorites.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I will be bringing you Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions by A. Square, coming to you this November and December 2009. If you've ever felt like you just don't quite fit in, well, you got nothing on A. Square, a two-dimensional guy who meets up with a three-dimensional woman in Flatland, a Victorian satirical novella by Edwin A. Abbott. Join us. You can get Craftlit at craftlit.com, or you can subscribe at iTunes.
This next segment came about in an interesting way. I was talking to Rose Meager on Skype when suddenly I realized that what she was telling me was an interesting story from the weaving world. So I asked her if I could record our conversation for Weavecast, and she graciously said yes.
Rose Meager from Baltimore, Maryland.
I hear that your guild has had a wonderful 60th anniversary and has done this really exciting project relating to that. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
We started this project about 2 years ago, knowing that our anniversary was coming up in 2009. The guild was established in 1949, and they've done some pretty formidable projects in the past. For their 50th anniversary, they did a napkin exchange and a big dinner. For the 40th anniversary, they did something called Weaving Baltimore, where they did large-scale transparencies of different sites in Baltimore, 28 different ones. And for both of these events, they did a book. It was published, but it was given to the people who were within the guild. So this time, we decided to do a scarf exchange. We chose scarves because scarves are an excellent forum for sampling hand-woven fabric. We mandated that it be an original design. They turned them in last December 4th, and we wanted 60 scarves to represent 60 years. And that segued into, well, then we could publish a book so that everybody would have all of the drafts. We have a lot of talent, beyond weaving talent, within the guild, and we utilized every bit of it. It's been an awesome project, a lot of hard work.
You were telling me it was an all-volunteer project, too.
Absolutely, yeah. The project was to get some interest going, to create camaraderie within the guild, and all of that happened. And pulling together all of the pieces to publish a book, the book has 60 full-color photos. For every single scarf, there's a full-color page. And on the left-hand side is the draft, the instructions. Once in a while, there's a little profile on the weaver themselves or their inspiration, if it was something that was relevant to the end product. And there is a detail swatch on the page. It's not actual fabric. It's a picture. But it shows you the detail of the thread. It's a very user-friendly book. It will be spiral-bound, going to sell for $29.95, and it's 144 pages long. It includes an introduction from Virginia West. she's been a member. We just had a little celebration for 50 years with the Weavers Guild of Greater Baltimore.
What's the book called?
The book is called 60 Scarves for 60 Years. We will have it, I believe, the first week of December.
Well, what was the biggest challenge that your group had to overcome in order to get the book done?
I guess editing. When it comes to drafts, I don't know anybody, a knitter, a weaver, a crochet, that doesn't start a project using directions out of a book, and they come across something that just totally throws them because it's wrong. No matter how many times you go over something and pour over it, you get so close to it that it becomes difficult to be objective, and you don't see the mistakes. So I would say that was one of the more challenging tasks. We've been working on it for a year now. There have been a number of little challenges along the way. And of course, when you're working with all volunteers, you have to be very mindful of the people that you're working with and the fact that they're using their own time. But overall, it's been a fantastic experience, and everybody is really thrilled about it and can't wait for it to hit the market. Caused a lot of excitement. People have dusted off looms. They have formed little study groups. There was a lot of dedication. People really took it seriously. They put a tremendous effort in it, whether they've been weaving for 2 years or 20 years. The book has a tremendous variety of different patterns. One woman did a scarf on an inkle loom. There was a scarf done on a triangular loom. There's 6 or 7 patterns that could be done on a rigid head of loom. There are several 24-shaft patterns.
Really?
Mm-hmm. There are a number of 16-shaft patterns. I can think of 2 10-shaft patterns. There's quite a few 8s. There's probably about 15 4-shaft patterns. They just go all over the place. There's every color under the sun. There's hand-painted warp, differential shrinkage scarves. There is hand-spun. One woman in the guild spins her own Samoyed dog hair, and she used that in her weft, and it's an absolutely gorgeous scarf that I think people will really be inspired by. And it's really, it's meant to be an inspirational book as much as a design collection. A lot of these fabrics could easily be used for jackets. The draft could be taken to other projects besides scarves. I think it's going to be a very beautiful book, and I think that weavers are going to love it.
It's really quite the microcosm of all the different weavers who are in your guild, then.
Exactly. And the patterns are as varied as the weavers themselves.
The funds that are raised from the sale of this book, are they earmarked for any special purpose?
They will go into the guild kitty. The idea really was never to make money on it so much as to pay for the project. It was kind of a leap of faith. We have a 12-member board. And when I presented the project, we actually have to spend well over half the money that the guild has. The idea is that we recoup the funds that we're spending. That's the priority. And then any funds that signed up with as a result of the book will become part of the treasury. If it's anything even remotely substantial, we have plans to, very loose plans, because we don't want to count eggs that aren't hatched, you know. But we have dreams of being able to do some pretty significant outreach programs. We have a member who, for the past 10 years, residing in Nairobi, Africa. She was also one of the contributors to the book. And there's a little story in there about what she's doing. She's there because her husband works for, I want to say, USAID. She's a dedicated weaver, and she's a teacher type of person. And she has hooked up with people in helping to advance cottage industries to help women have a way to make a living that are in dire straits in Africa. And she's also organized efforts to get materials and tools donated. And she desperately would love to have a couple of people come over and teach. But of course, she has no funding for it. She'd love to have a spinning instructor, and she would love to have a teacher in tapestry. She's played a very significant role in helping this niche group of people. And she would love to expand it in the time that she's there. She's working with some different grant programs, and she's making inroads and efforts, but it's kind of slow going, especially with the world economy the way that it is. We thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could help with that? That's sort of one of those, you know, kind of a little pipe dream, but not completely out of the realm of possibilities.
Sounds like a neat project and a book that I'd love to see. What are you going to do with your free afternoons now that the book is out the door?
I'd like to weave again. My poor looms. They're empty.
Next up, Anna Zinsmeister brings us an interview with Joanne Hall, where they talk about the fascinating subject of draw loom weaving. I recently got the chance to weave on a draw loom at Madeline Vanderhoot's Weaver School. Now, it's not a fast way to weave, but the ability to create intricate designs without having to hand pick up each block makes it well worth the extra time. A draw loom typically starts out as a standard countermarche loom, which then has a second set of shafts added to it. Now, the first set of shafts weaves the ground cloth, whether that's plain weave or twill or damask, and the second set controls the pattern pickup. I only know of a few places in the United States that you can study draw loom weaving, so it's a real treat to hear from Joanne Hall on this relatively rare form of weaving.
My name is Anna Zinsmeister, and I'm a member of Weave Cast Ensemble, and I'm interviewing Joanne Hall today. Welcome, Joanne Hall.
Perhaps we should start by saying that I've just had three wonderful days with Anna here weaving on my draw looms, and we have met briefly before at a conference when I knew that Anna was coming, and we have corresponded before because Anna got a draw loom. So we have communicated before, and we have gotten to know each other by email. So that might be a good way to introduce all of this discussion.
And then we've learned to know each other better this week for the last almost five days now. You've been teaching not just me, but three other people who were here at various times, and that's pretty much what your schedule is, that you have people coming and going in your studio to teach various aspects of weaving.
Yes, and fewer people is always better for a class.
Yes, and you have a very nice studio here with many Glamocre looms and then one Leclerc loom. You teach beginning weaving and also more advanced weaving, and the students that were here were learning beginning weaving on how to warp. I guess what we can talk about to start with is what makes a Swedish loom special. I mean, do you want to talk about that first?
Okay. Well, I started out with a homemade loom that my husband made, and it was fashioned after the looms that I wove on in Mexico with a hanging beater and a large frame. And those looms are actually copies of European looms because they're not the native Mexican loom. And after that, I wove on many different kinds of collected looms and purchased looms, many of them typical of what most weavers use, with the lower beater and a much smaller loom. And over the years, I found that often students had problems with those looms because of their small size. So I've gravitated back to that original loom that I started out with that I enjoyed weaving on with the hanging beater and the large frame. So I learned from experience that it's a better style for comfort and for your back and for your legs and for your arms. It's much more comfortable. I always wanted the Swedish looms, but when you're young, of course, it's very expensive to buy new looms. So I always wanted them, and I taught on them when I traveled to teach, so I was able to weave on them at that time. But It took a while before I could accumulate them in the studio. First, I sold off the very smallest ones, and I concentrated on counterbalance looms, but most of them had the lower beater and were small, so over the years I've replaced them with the Swedish looms.
And what? When did you actually encounter Swedish looms?
I taught on some Bergman countermarsh looms, but Bergman was a Swedish lady, so they were based on Swedish design. So in 73 I taught for the summer on Bergman looms. Mm. So I've been weaving a long time.
Yes, I know. I know you have. The overhead beater is one difference between the Swedish looms and the American looms. What else are differences between them?
In Sweden, they don't use jack looms. They always have counterbalance or countermarsh looms. So that's a big difference besides the hanging beater. The Swedish looms, besides having the hanging beater, are very tall. You can hang things from the castle, which makes warping the loom a lot easier. They are deeper looms, so that the warp is stretched further from the front to the back. That makes opening a shed a lot easier. It makes warping the loom a lot easier. And then you have the counterbalance and the countermarsh tie-ups, which give you a nicer, cleaner shed. And you can make the shed whatever size you want, so you have a lot of choices. And the treadling is very easy. Because the breast beam is taller, you sit more comfortably with better posture. And I had a lot of that in my first homemade loom. So over the years, I've sold the little looms, and I have the Glimoker looms for students to weave on because they are easier to warp, and they're more comfortable to weave at. You can weave for a longer period of time, and I don't have students getting up to stretch their back.
So one of the things that I think makes people uneasy about working on Swedish looms is the tie-up of the countermarsh.
Right, and I've explained that many times over the phone when people call me. I had a woman from Canada call me, telling me she wanted to sell her Glimoker countermarsh loom. It sounded like she wanted to keep weaving, and she, in many ways, liked her loom. So I asked her why she wanted to sell it. And I said I could help her to sell it because a lot of people want used looms. So she told me it was the tie-up. So I explained to her that the tie-up is basically the same as the jack loom or the counterbalance loom that she might be familiar with. But after she had tied it up as that type of loom, all she had to do was fill the holes on the treadle. So that if you think of a jack loom where you have the treadle raising the shafts, you just insert extra cords on the other set of lambs to pull the other shafts down. And because your treadle is then pulling those shafts down, the lower part of your shed is always tight. And so when she understood that, then that was the end of the conversation. And a month later, she called me back to order something for her Glimoker loom. And I said, I thought you were going to sell it. She said, well, once you explained to me how it worked, I had no problem with it. And when I have students who work on the countermarsh loom as beginners who have never woven on anything else, they have no problem at all.
I guess it's just the intimidation of the difference between...
Yeah, and you don't get intimidated if you haven't started on a different loom and become somehow fearful of change. So if you start with a countermarsh loom as your very first loom, you have nothing to fear because you have not been told to fear it.
Yeah, they're very quiet looms, and the shed snaps back in place each time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, I didn't mention the quiet part. They are very quiet. Usually the shuttle is the part that makes the most noise. So that's a change from other looms.
When I got my draw loom attachment, there is another fear. What is a draw loom, and how is that different from the next step from a regular loom?
Many weavers are familiar with pickup weaves, where you use your fingers or a pickup stick to pick up threads, creating a new shed that's different than the loom can give you. And then you weave that shed. And you can think of a draw loom as a very large loom that looks very, very complicated, but in the end it's just doing that pickup for you. And it does it every time just by pulling a cord or pulling a handle. It automatically does that pickup that you would normally do by hand, so that you get the ability to make complex patterns, non-repeating patterns or repeating patterns, very simply and quickly compared to doing them by hand. Basically, there are two weaves that are done on a draw loom, a damask and a pamta. Although you can weave rugs and you can weave many other things, those are the two most popular weaves in Sweden. And so if you've looked at the book Damask and Opemta, there's a lot of information about weaving those two basic weaves, but it's not limited to those two. The damask is done on 5 shafts or more, although you can do a broken twill on 4 and get the look of damask, and so that keeps it really simple. The opemta looks a lot like overshot, but you have many, many blocks, and it does have a little different look in that you don't have the half tone in between. So you get a sharper pattern with more contrast. So damask and opemta, the two most popular in Sweden.
The opemta, I finally said it right.
I should explain. Damask is fairly easy for Americans to understand. Opemta might be a new word for them, and it actually just means pick up. Op means up, and hemta is a verb to pick, so okay. Pick up. And it's up, opemta.
Opemta.
Opemta. Yeah.
I'm getting better at that word. It's been a difficult word for me this weekend.
So those are the two most popular weaves in Sweden for the draw loom, but you can do other things. But the two basic types of looms can weave either of them. It's just that the design is different. So if you have a shaft draw loom, it means that you can add many shafts that are called pattern shafts. And they're easy to thread, and you divide them after they're threaded onto as many shafts as you want. And even in the middle of a weave, you can take a 10-shaft pattern shaft setup, and right there while you're weaving, you set down your shuttle, and you can go back and make it into a 20-shaft weave just by inserting more pattern shafts and do a larger pattern. But a shaft loom weaves repeat patterns. So you might have just 10 handles above your beater. The wider the warp is, the more repeats you have. So you might have 20 repeats of the pattern across your warp on a wide warp, and you still only have 10 handles to pull to do all of that weaving. The other type of loom ties up one cord to each of those 5 threads on a 5-shaft satin. So one cord pulls up 5 threads. So if you have a wide warp and a complex pattern, you have a cord for every 5 threads, and you're pulling a lot of cords. But if you want to do fine detail and non-repeating patterns, you would get a single unit draw loom where you can pick up single units. And these are used for images, for writing words, for writing your name, or anything where there's not a repeat in the pattern, although you can pull the cords to make a repeat pattern.
And you can have a loom that's a combination of both.
Yes.
The other thing that I think some people don't know is that there's actually two harnesses. There's one that's the ground harness and one that's the pattern harness.
Right. So when you're setting up a weave, say you're going to do a damask, and you want it to be very practical and maybe thicker threads, you might just set up a broken twill if you want little finer threads, you might set up a satin, which gives you a little longer float than twill does. Six shafts also makes a nice satin with a little longer float, so you would use little finer threads for that and a closer set. That would be the ground weave. So you choose the basic weave structure that you want to do. But on that basic weave, you can do many different things. And you set up the pattern shafts based on how big a pattern you want. So if you want big diamonds, you make more pattern shafts. If you want little diamonds, you don't need so many pattern shafts. The ground shafts and pattern shafts are separated by at least 18 inches so that you're weaving your ground shaft of your satin very close to your beater to get your basic weave. And then the pattern shafts are halfway between the ground shafts and the back of your loom, or at least 18 inches behind the ground shafts.
And I guess the other thing that's interesting about this loom is that it has the long eyed heddles in the ground so that the pattern can go, it can do two different things. The one thread will do different things within the weave structure.
For someone who has never used long eyed heddles, it might be very confusing. The basic idea is, in order for pattern sheds to have an effect on your weave, if you raise a pattern shaft, you're raising the threads. And if you had normal eyes on your ground shaft heddles, nothing would happen. But if you have a long eye, you're creating a shed within that eye.
How many inches is a long eye heddle?
About 2.5 inches.
That's the size of the eye.
They come in different lengths, but the eye is always the same.
About 2 inches. Mm-hmm. And then how long are the pattern?
The pattern heddles are about 20 inches long, but of course you don't need a long eye because there's no shed happening there, so it's a normal eye.
And then there's something different about the pattern shafts too.
Yes, we have wind chimes on our
feet. They make
and
sounds.
They tinkle when you're weaving, making a very nice sound. The pattern shafts hang low in the loom and hold the threads lower, and they're held down by weights, and they're like a long U-shaped piece of metal, and they weigh about 2 ounces each. And they hold the pattern heddles down straight. For each weight, you have 5 threads. You're holding on 5 threads if you have a 5-shaft satin.
The fact that there are maybe 3 or more pattern shafts, the pattern shafts don't really raise and lower at all. It's the cords attached to each.
Right. The wooden part, the wood shaft part, doesn't move, but when you pull a single unit up, you're pulling the heddle up, just those 5 threads.
It's similar to a jacquard loom where the threads are individually pulled up,
yeah.
Except that this is pulled up in units.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, unlike the regular loom, it has a dip in it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you were explaining.
For the pattern shafts.
Right. So how low is the dip between the breast beam and the...
Oh, about 3 inches between where the thread normally comes across. So then they would go up another 3 inches beyond that when they're raised.
And then I guess we should explain about the weights that are needed for the, or the rubber bands that are needed for the ground shafts.
Right. When you weave opempta, you type your treadles in the normal way. But when you weave damask, you want to have a shed where you create a float. Satin is made by having a float over 4 of those threads and under 1. And it's that long float that gives you the light reflection so that you see the difference between the warp-faced and the weft-faced weave. So you can weave something with 1 color and still see the pattern because the way the light reflects off those long floats. So when you're weaving, you need a shed with 4 down and 4 up. But because the loom is weaving part of your pattern web-faced and part of it warp-faced, you have to have one shaft that goes up and one shaft that goes down in your ground weave. And the other three remain in place. So your treadle is only tied to two of the shafts, one to go up, one to go down, and is not holding those other three shafts at all, like a normal countermarch tie-up would do, or a normal counterbalance tie-up, where you push on a treadle and your foot is controlling all of the shafts. So with damask, you're only controlling two shafts, and the other three are supposed to remain in place. And so there are three ways to hold them in place. In the old days, they made sandbags and used any kind of a weight that would counterweight those shafts because they have a tendency to fall, especially on a wide warp. And so the draw looms that became popular in the U.S. in the 70s had metal bars that were called counterweights, and they would hang on the outside of the loom. But as time went by, weavers realized that there were two other very good ways to control those shafts that were not controlled by the treadle. Today, the most common way is to use elastic bands that are hung from the top of the loom. They're the same elastic bands that have been used for a long time to control narrow warps on wide counterbalance looms, where you need a little control of the shaft bars. So they're just loops of elastic that are on the ends of the shaft bar. And when you pull a shaft down, the elastic is stretched. But it's tight enough on the stationary shafts to hold them.
So it's a special kind of it's a special elastic that's made for the looms.
Mm-hmm. And it has little holes in it, so like the Texolve cord, so that it's easy to tie them up. So that's the second way to hold those shafts.
How wide is it? How wide is the elastic?
The elastic's about 5/8 inches wide, and you cut them approximately 18 inches long, so that you have a loop that's 9 inches long to put on the shaft bar. Mm-hmm. And then you just tie them to the top of the loom, and the Texolve cord makes it very easy. On my other draw loom, in the other room, we have them on the side of the loom because we have a vertical countermarch on that loom, and it's just as easy to put them on the side of the loom. So there's two different ways to tie them up.
Oh, right. It crosses over the actual frame of the mm-hmm. loom and is connected. It's connected to
just to the metal bar, just to the stationary part of the loom.
I see.
And it's just an easy way to tie it up. With the horizontal countermarch, you make the loops that I just described and put them on the end of the shaft bars.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you are getting more people interested in draw loom weaving?
Yes. And it's interesting, there are a lot of men who come to weave on the draw loom.
Why do you think that is?
Perhaps because initially the loom looks really complicated.
Yeah.
And as we were saying a couple of days ago, when you started weaving, I said, you know, this looks so complicated, but when it comes right down to it, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, I think that from my understanding is that the hardest thing to do is to just get all those cords tied up, but once they're tied up.
Yes, and it's helpful to weave on a draw loom first because then you know what you're doing. When you're tying something up, you know what the purpose is.
It makes more sense when everything's laid together. Mm-hmm. I guess we should mention too that there's also a second reed on the draw loom.
Yes, and on the single unit draw loom, you have an extra reed. It isn't necessary for the shaft draw loom. It's because on the shaft draw loom, you have the wooden handles in a framework that stay very nicely organized. But when you have, like we have here, 80 cords and a little over 400 warp ends, you have 80 cords to control. And so threading them through a reed helps to control them.
And then there's another way that they're controlled too. The color coding, the...
Yes, yes. I chose to have white, gray, and blue on my cords because I made my own. they come in black and white, and you line them up so that you can count easily. So you'll have 10 white and 10 black, and then repeat that across the warp. That way you can find your place on the pattern. Of course, there's a wonderful computer program for doing that.
Of course.
You can download from the Pikes Peak Weavers Guild website, and it's free. It's a wonderful program called Weave Design. A Swedish couple who live in Colorado made this. Bengt Nelson made it for his wife, Steve. She was a weaving instructor in Sweden, and they settled in Colorado. And they've been wonderful resources for the people of the area. And you can download this program, and you can use it to take a photograph and convert that to graph paper and weave that photograph on a draw loom. You can also just take graph paper and pencil and sit down and start making your own design. Or you can take a photograph. I used to just take a photograph and blow it up to whatever size I wanted on an ordinary copy machine. And then I would convert that to graph paper and just weave it. You color code your graph paper that you're going to work from. So you would mark off 10 squares of white and 10 squares of black and continue across your graph paper so that when you pull the cords, you just follow your plan and it just happens on your weaving then.
It makes it a lot easier to follow the design when you're doing that, because I think I was working with 80 cords, and so having them color-coded and the color coding matching the graph paper made it easier to find where I was. Though still it was a little confusing at times.
Yeah. It takes a little practice, just like anything else,
to
follow that graph paper design.
The shaft loom was definitely a lot easier because of the handles. But again, like you said, you don't have the same versatility because you're in within a pattern.
Right.
But it's still very versatile. You can get some unusual designs.
And if you want to, you can put on 50 shafts or whatever you want and do some very elaborate patterns. And you can put more shafts on the loom. And although it takes longer to set it up, if you have many shafts on the loom, each one controlling 5 threads, you can do a single unit image.
Oh, so that you can almost go back to the other and have that free.
Right, if you have enough shafts.
Where did you learn to do draw loom weaving?
I learned by getting the loom, having it sent to me, and I just used whatever references were available and did. I was only doing the single unit, so that simplifies it if you just decide on one type of weaving to do. And I made it only a 10-inch warp. And I wanted to do images, so I had ordered a single unit draw loom for my first draw loom. And I had a lot of fun. All I had to do was tie up my draw cords, and it's really very simple when you start with something simple. And then I went to Sweden, and I visited the place where the draw loom is made, and I stayed with them for 3 days. The daughter has now taken over the business. She had small children at the time, so she was not doing very much weaving at the time. But it's a very lovely family, and I revisited them this last winter. And Robert, it happened to be his birthday. He was, I can't remember how old, but I think he's in his 80s now. And so it was nice to visit with them again.
What was the name of the family?
It's Robert Myrihed, and Inger is his wife, and the daughter's name is Karin.
Oh.
And she now has the business.
So they make the draw looms that the attachments that go on the other looms.
Yes, they do.
So there's a difference between the actual loom company and the draw loom attachments.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Actually, he came up with such a wonderful design that Glimokra quit making the looms, the draw loom attachments they had been making.
So they had been making them at one time.
Right, and Robert came up with a little better design. He and his daughter, who went to the Stenneby Skolan in Dalsland in Sweden, came up with this design, and it's so very functional that the Glamocre Loom Company just started selling their draw looms instead of the ones they had been making in the past.
What would you suggest if somebody wanted to take up draw loom weaving? What would you suggest they do?
Oh, well, they could come here if they want to.
That's true.
But also, if they can't come here, I can give them other people that they can visit. Although I had a woman come from Istanbul, Turkey, to learn draw loom weaving here. I've had people come from many different places to weave here. And they're welcome to come.
Yes, and you do other things besides teaching. You are a distributor of Glamocre.
Yes, and you can see the looms here also when you come.
And actually get to try them out.
Mm-hmm.
You and your husband, Ed, attend different shows in different areas and different conferences and things like that.
Yeah, we try to go to as many as we can. We go to more on the West Coast since we're located in Montana, but we try to attend 5 or 6 every year so that we can set up the looms and people can see what the looms look like, sit down and try them, and get to know a little bit more about the looms.
There was the question that one of the students from your class this week asked. Do you remember what the question was?
Yes, I do. She wanted to know what my next weaving project would be that I would like to do. And actually, much of my work is setting up looms for conferences, also testing some of the new looms that Glamocre has designed. But we raised sheep for many years, and towards the end it became difficult to sell the fleece. And so it piled up in the barn, and finally I had some processed. And I would like to take some of that and weave a blanket on the draw loom using the single unit to do a border. I haven't decided what it would be, but something about sheep and sleeping. Maybe not counting sheep, but something along that line. Because with the single unit draw loom, you can write a sentence across your blanket. And I thought that would be fun to do. See that those white tall cones over there from the sheep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so you actually had it, when you say processed, it wasn't just processed
into yarn.
Yeah.
That's for my blankets for someday. I do have that in mind to do a nice wide blanket.
You were talking about testing the looms. I thought that was a really interesting thing that you were doing, that you're now helping Glamocre by testing the looms and also writing instructions for the looms for American weavers, which is a really nice thing.
Yes. Actually, weavers in the U.S. Work a little differently than Swedish weavers. We like to pack up a portable loom, put it in our car or on an airplane, and go to workshops where we learn how to do something. And then when we come home, we work on our large loom, or we might even weave on a smaller loom. In Sweden, when you take a class, the looms are already there. You don't have to pack up a loom. And so portable, foldable looms have never been an important part of weaving looms in Sweden, but they are here. And so the two markets are very different. In Sweden, they want a big loom and they're happy with one big loom. Here in the U.S., more people will start out with small looms. Perhaps they're intimidated by a big loom, whereas Swedish weavers are not. They're accustomed to seeing big looms. Looms in Sweden have always been big. And so when they want to weave, they expect to start on a big loom. And that's not the case here. When the Swedish immigrants came to America, they usually brought their reed because that was the difficult part to make. But the looms are so big, they wouldn't want to bring a big loom because the first part of the big wave of immigration was in the middle 1800s. Women still wove, but they certainly couldn't afford to bring those big timbers with them. So they made the looms. And I've done a lot of research in Minnesota about the immigrants and the looms that they brought. And so Americans look at looms a little bit differently, and we are trying to provide looms for that market. So we've introduced some new smaller looms, trying to make them more portable so that we can put them in cars for the American market. And because that's not a part of their culture in Sweden, I've been doing a lot of testing of these small looms. And then, of course, we also work differently with them, so I'm writing instructions for the looms as well. It's so much a part of their culture that there's always an aunt or a grandmother or a cousin who lives nearby who will come over and set it up for you and show you what to do. And we don't have that kind of advantage here in the U.S. We have to work independently, and we need good instructions then. So I work a lot with the company on these issues.
It's a good cultural exchange, I'm sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the other day when you were weaving on the draw loom, you asked about the differences between Swedish and American weaving. And of course, today with the increased communications, we know more about weaving in other countries, and we communicate more with weavers from other places. And in the 90s, when the weaving list started, I signed up for one, and through that list I met Suzanne Castanius. And I decided to write to her because she was from Sweden and because she said she had just woven 2 tablecloths for her twin children. And I thought I should get to know her. And because of the increased communications, of course, we know more about each other, the weaving of Sweden, and Americans can read the Swedish Weaving magazine and learn about Swedish weaving. And Suzanne recently wrote an article for the most recent issue of the magazine. In the past, of course, we didn't have this kind of communication. And during the Industrial Revolution, most American looms got put into the barn and were destroyed later on and were not used. But in Sweden, the importance of weaving continued through the Industrial Revolution because it was such an important part of their culture. Grandmothers and mothers would teach their daughters to weave, and they would weave practical things for their future. They wove sheets and pillowcases and towels, and they often wove the fabric for their folk costume. And towards the end of the 1800s, the arts and crafts movement came, and there were people in Sweden who decided that if more and more people give up weaving, they will lose this cultural heritage. And so they traveled around the provinces collecting fabrics. Weaving schools were opened. Many weavers became more and more interested in weaving. In this country, what happened at that time is weavers started to take the old looms and make them into 2-shaft looms and weave rag rugs. And a number of companies started making looms based on industrial looms, making simple 2 and sometimes 4-shaft looms for weaving rugs. These looms were made as copies of industrial looms. They were short. They didn't have the hanging beater. They had a lot of metal parts. They didn't have the nice feel of the wood. In Sweden, this did not happen. Instead, a neighborhood might send someone to one of these weaving schools where they would learn how to weave on a draw loom. They wanted to do more complicated weaving. They wanted to improve the weaving of their community. That person would come back and teach everybody else how to weave on the draw loom and how to do quality weaving to continue their cultural heritage. And so even when weaving was revived in this country, it was much, much different than the revival in Sweden, where complex weaving and maintaining traditional quality was important. Here, they wanted to weave rag rugs on metal looms. The American weavers did not have grandmothers to help. And they didn't have anyone in the family to show them how to weave, and they didn't have that loom in the barn to bring into the house to start weaving. So they had to create that loom and that weaving tradition all over again. And so it was created a much different way than it had been done in the past. And people here in the U.S. became interested in more complex weaving and weaving with finer threads and weaving with more traditional looms. So although some beginners want to start with the little looms and they're intimidated by the big ones, we still have the option of the traditional loom.
Is part of your interest in Swedish weaving because of your own heritage?
Yes, that's part of it, although I am truly an American, even though my ancestors were Swedish.
But I mean, it's part of your
yes.
ancestors' mm-hmm. heritage, and so that might have drawn you to it?
No, I don't think it did originally.
Really? Okay.
No, I was interested in weaving because I saw it around. Mm-hmm. First, I went to Mexico, and
oh,
right. I wrote my book, Mexican Tapestry. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in tapestry and contemporary weaving. So the interest in Swedish weaving was more looking at contemporary tapestry work from Europe and Sweden and other places. And so that was my connection. It wasn't till I was older and more experienced with weaving that I could see some of the reasons for studying Swedish weaving.
The other thing that we didn't talk about, which maybe we should too, is that you have written several books. And
after the tapestry weaving book, I did a lot of teaching here in my studio, and I traveled a lot. Most of the time when I traveled, I taught for guilds or at conferences, and I taught tapestry weaving. And I had to weave, of course, on their looms, and I had experience then with just about every type of table loom made in this country. It was nice when some of the folding or portable floor looms were introduced, because it makes it a lot easier to demonstrate tapestry weaving if you have treadles. It goes a lot faster. But then I started to become interested in more traditional weaving, and in my studio I was teaching many different kinds of weaving. And so, along with other weavers in this country, I became interested in lots of different kinds of weaving besides tapestry.
And then you eventually wrote the book on tying up the countermarsh loom, which
right.
is really helpful.
In the 80s, I started developing teaching handouts for helping beginners learn not only about the weaves, but also the warping. And one of the best sources I had was a book I picked up in Sweden that was a booklet on warping the loom, written by the same woman who wrote the book many weavers now see in English called The Big Book of Weaving.
Okay.
So I've been teaching from The Big Book of Weaving, from the original first edition, for about 30 years. And now that it's in English, I don't have to use those handouts. Working on those handouts developed the book on countermarch tie-up. And I felt a great need for that because I was spending a lot of time on the phone and sending email messages trying to explain the countermarch loom. And so we needed a book that would tell people step-by-step what to do. Because although you can explain the concept, it's nice to have a little more detail.
Yeah, it helps. And so you are really good at doing that. I mean, that's part of also what you do with Glumacras, is
yeah.
writing instructions for other types of looms, like the Julia
right.
and things like that, and the rigid heta loom.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a good skill.
And with the computers the way they are today, we can just print them out, and I can edit those instructions. We don't have to have 6,000 copies made, and then we're stuck with that for a long time. We can edit those instructions anytime anyone has a question about anything. I can change the instructions to be more clear or or add a diagram as needed. So with our computers, it makes it a lot easier to provide instructions for weavers.
That's true. And you also are able to insert photographs and things like mm-hmm. that, which are really helpful.
Yes. So I'm thankful for that.
That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.